Hello, I'm Ramsey Campbell, and you're listening to Monsters, Madness, and Magic.
All right, folks, welcome to the Monsters, Madness, and Magic podcast. I'm your host, Justin, here with a quick word before we dive in. Now, in this episode, I'm joined by special guest co-host Howie Bentley of Cauldron Born and Britain Writes, and we chat with legendary author Ramsey Campbell about classical music, horror films, Clark Ashton Smith, H.P. Lovecraft, writing fiction that drips with dread, and more. As always, thank you all for listening out there. And if you'd like to help the show grow and you're listening on your podcasting platform of choice, please leave us a review. And if you happen to be watching the video on YouTube, please like, comment, and subscribe because it does help. Anyway, without further ado, here you go.
Greetings, boils and ghouls. This is your comrade, the Crypt Keeper here, reporting dead from the sanctuary of the strange. Tonight's macabre myth is a fright-filled feature, one overflowing with monsters, madness, and magic.
Mr. Campbell, why don't you take us back in time? You're a youngster. Are you a book reader, fort builder, troublemaker, or all the above?
Oh, very much a book reader, I would say. I was probably too insular to cause much trouble. But I was horribly precocious. Reading books by the age of two. By the age of six, I was reading Edith Wharton, specifically a ghost story called Afterward, in 50 Years of Ghost Stories, which was the very first adult book I ever borrowed from the local public library on my mother's ticket with her say so. So yeah, books were it for me for pretty well all my pre-teen years.
Now, whereabouts did you grow up? Were you Liverpool, born and bred?
Yeah, Liverpool for sure. I lived in what was supposed to be a sort of model suburb, it's a kind of idyllic suburb that was built in the during the First World War, actually, to some extent, I think, to take people out of the slums into a more, amenable environment. But I have to say, the house was very small. It had two rooms downstairs, three bedrooms, and a bathroom toilet. Some I managed to get fitted in on the upper story. But honestly, if you can, I know you see a room behind me. This is my workroom from where I'm talking to you. And honestly, I don't think the entire floor plan of the house was much bigger than this one room. So it has to be said that when my parents became estranged when I was very young, the situation, became increasingly odd because they didn't actually move apart. They still lived in the same house. They just didn't talk to each other. And because I had to choose sides at my mother's behest, I went with my mother, which meant that my father became this unseen presence in the house. The footsteps coming up the stairs at night, or the turning doorknob and the presence on the other side of the door. And he became a sort of object of terror for me, not least because my mother was a, dare I say, undiagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, and she was convinced that he was out to kill us, and that the neighbours were conspiring against her with him and other much more of the same kind. So, some say this is why I write what I write, but and there may be some truth in that, but I think I've always loved horror fiction. For as long as I can remember, I always loved the experience of being terrified by, fiction. But maybe the kind of preoccupation you find in some of my stuff with, extreme psychological states and the like, and also, misperceptions, things that appear to be one thing but in fact are another, those may have their roots in my early life.
So do you think growing up in the post-war Liverpool, you're growing up in the wake of World War II, do you think that influenced your interest in horror that early?
Not directly, no. But what I think it did do was give me a background, and the Liverpool of those days certainly shows up in a lot of my fiction. Not least because in the 60s, and the 60s, I have to explain when I started going to see horror movies, because in England in those days, Britain, nearly all horror movies had an X certificate, which meant you had to be or appear to be 16 years or older to get in to see them. Well, by the time I was 14, I convinced myself I could bluff my way past the box office, which indeed I did. And this meant that, I was finding every cinema in Liverpool I could find, because in those days they were already beginning to close down, but there were lots and lots of suburban cinemas, and I would go and visit them all. And often this meant walking through, honestly, miles of blitzed streets, houses with no roof, and probably with no, half a wall, that sort of stuff. And just the deserted landscapes where you never would encounter anybody else, well, nearly always. And actually, that shows up much later on in the first volume of my trilogy, The Searching Dead. I mean, that the Liverpool described in that of the 50s is very much my memory of what Liverpool was like back then. And of course, I think that preoccupation with sort of urban desolation, yeah, that certainly did influence the way, the sort of thing that I write.
You mentioned that your parents were estranged. Were either of them artistically or creatively inclined at all? Do you think that's where some of your roots lie?
Yes. Well, I mean, my mother sadly was a failed writer, but she wrote a lot. But she was hardly ever published. A couple of short stories, I think, she sold to newspapers and small journals in the, around the, before the Second World War. But after this, partly because she wanted to finance getting out of this marriage, because apart from as a Catholic, she couldn't get divorced. Separation was the word the most that you could really manage, in terms of her beliefs. So she tried writing novels to make money, to make a separate, her own income. But sadly, they were never published. And in fact, she eventually sent one to August Derleth at Arkham House, which is a science fantasy novel, a kind of a satire, but Derleth felt that it wasn't, the fantastic element wasn't really necessary to what she was saying, so he sent it back, much to her disappointment.
I'm just curious, do you have any of her stories? Do they survive to this day at all?
Yes, I've got a few. And in fact, I mean, I did do a piece. Where does this appear now? Oh, it's in my second non-fiction collection, which is Ramsay Campbell Certainly, it's called, which is all sorts of non-fiction. And one of the major essays in there, well, it's hardly even an essay, actually. What it is my parents' correspondence before they were married, and to a certain extent after, and some of my mother's papers. And one of the novels I summarize and quote from one of her novels, and I think you can get a fair sense of it. They were perfectly competently written, but it seemed to me, looking back even then, they seemed dated to me, as a well, I suppose in my early teens when I read that one, and now it seems perfectly clear that they were sort of several decades too late in terms of how they were written and what they were about. A pity, but I mean, in the case of somebody like Lovecraft, of course, that works perfectly well. He is out of his time, but unfortunately, the kind of various popular genres she was attempting. I mean, she had to go to detective novels, she had to go to a school story, all sorts of things, but again, just too late.
Being a teenager growing up in the 60s, what sort of records are spinning around your house?
Oh, well, I mean, I confess to ghastly things such as the liking for Cliff Richard, Tommy Steele, these guys. And then a bit later, I got on to, well, no, I have to be a couple of years later, I got on to the Beatles. Although, weirdly enough, the only really, the reason I got on to the Beatles was that I read a review in the Village Voice, of all places, a newspaper I used to collect, because it had Andrew Saris's film reviews in it, which I loved. And there was a review of Revolver claiming it to be, a major work of musical invention. I thought, well, I'm going to check this out. Duly bought it, and was indeed flabbergasted by the inventiveness of it. And so I then, started following the Beatles. Although, funnily enough, I had actually seen them in person once at the Cavern. The club where they often used to perform in Liverpool, when I was, oh, I would have been 16, I think. I just started working in an office, and one of the guys, my colleagues, he was a great Beatles fan. So, go and see these guys, they're great. So we duly did, and were deafened by them, because the acoustic is terrible, basically, in terms of deafening the audience. So, I've known people actually go in there these days with earplugs so they can just hear the music at the right level. But the Beatles weren't quite that loud at that time. And I have to say, that experience wasn't formative. I don't remember exactly what they were playing. I assume they were mostly cover versions at that stage. But later on, yeah, the Beatles for sure. And then I got onto Frank Zappa, various other guys, the Jefferson Airplane, and then the Stones, the Rolling Stones. And I was beginning to get into classical music as well, which now becomes is my great love in terms of music. Classical in the widest sense, from kind of early Baroque to the present day.
I just finished The Fellstones recently,
Yes.
and great, great novel. I bought my mom a copy too. She just read
Oh,
it. She really enjoyed it.
thank you, thank you.
Well, thank you for writing it. One of the things I noticed was you are a big fan of classical music, in that you even reference Schoenberg in it.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, that was a pretty cool name drop there. I was wondering if you're going to mention Webern and Alvin
Yeah.
Berry too.
Yep. That's
Yeah,
right. That's right. And there
really
is
enjoyed
indeed
it.
that, the thing is, I said about Schoenberg and the Glenn Gould recording, and you can indeed hear him humming along, finding a melody, within what we assume to be non-melodic music, well, 12 tone anyway. But
Atonal,
he,
yeah.
of course, he was always famous for humming along with what he was playing, which is, something you've got to get used to. But it's fascinating to hear him finding that there,
I want to mention to you, back to the thing when you were going to the cinema when you were a teenager to see those horror films. Were you a fan of the Giallo?
Not at that time, no, because they weren't really released in Britain around then, but I've certainly become one. I mean, Mario Bava and Argento in particular. Yeah, I mean, Blood and Black Lace, which is now has a wonderful ultra high definition 4K disc, which I recommend to anybody who can play it. It's just stunning. But equally, Deep Red, I'm very fond of. Tenebrae, I like a lot. I mean, there was a time actually when these films were banned on British home video. There was a whole panic in the early 80s, the police seizing stuff from, video libraries, so that some of us would then go around the video libraries to collect the stuff that was had been withdrawn, because often enough, you offer them money, they'd bring out the stuff they couldn't put on public show. That was how I first found Tenebrae, actually, on an old VHS tape. And equally, they've pretty well all now been restored to wonderful quality. Actually, even something earlier, like the Girl Who Knew Too Much, the Mario Bava. I've always liked that. And there are other things like the Fifth Chord and so forth. But I think it's Bava and Argento for me, for sure, in terms of that particular genre.
I thought you might say that the Demons by Daylight, there's a story in there. What was it? At First Sight. So was
Yeah.
that directly influenced by the Giallo with the Black Glove Killer, or?
Oh no, strange that. No, it was long before I'd seen any of those movies. In fact, I thought it was written. Let me see, that would have been written in, gosh, but I think 67. So, no, they haven't even got to England at that point, no. Prescient, you may say, prescient, who
Yeah.
knows?
This is lining up perfectly because Ramsey, this is just funny. After when this episode airs, the one I'm editing now before this one airs is Claudio Simonetti.
Oh, very
Yeah.
good,
So that's
excellent,
that just
excellent.
advertising the show prior to this one. So this is something I like to ask everyone. What scared you as a kid?
Oh, many things. My father, certainly, as this ominous presence. I mean, well, basically, most of the stories that I read once I got into horror, I mean, and this is kind of strange, because there was a time when I had a bit of a theory that, reading horror, somehow kind of packaged up the terrors of my childhood in, a sort of symbolic form, if you like, and so I could, put them away. But actually, since I used to lie awake at night remembering the one I just read, like, an M.R. James story, something like that. I mean, it's probably James above all who haunted me, the all these images of, putting your hand under a pillow to fetch something and finding there's a mouth under there, or pulling a bag, which is supposedly a bag of treasure, out of a niche in a wall, and having it put its arms around your neck. Well, believe me, I didn't easily forget those things once I went to bed. And so, in a sense, it couldn't have been. It wasn't being taken away. Quite the contrary. It was coming at me in a more intense form. Once I'd read the story. And so, I think it was simply the experience, the aesthetic experience, if you like, of terror. that appealed to me. I mean, the last time I was, well, I mean, as a now we're talking about a teenager, actually, now, in my, that, I mean, one of the other strange things about my childhood, and you may find this extremely odd, was that even though I had a single bed, I shared it with my mother for several years, including into early adolescence, because my grandmother was living with us. Of course, there were only three bedrooms. And obviously, you know, my mother was not going to my father's bedroom. And it was after my grandmother died, sadly, when I was, it would have been 14, I believe. And so, you know, my mother then had her room. And for weeks, and I it wasn't that I was afraid of my grandmother or her ghost. I mean, if I had sensor in the house, I think that would have been absolutely fine. You know, I would have found that, you know, perfectly benevolent. But for some weeks, I was just absolutely terrified of the dark. All of a sudden, I hadn't been, but suddenly this mechanism came into play, and I could never understand, you know, what it was that terrified me so much. You know, eventually it went away, and actually I use that in a story called The Companion. Actually, that's just drawing on my own experience.
So Ramsey, how early on do you begin to experiment creative writing and maybe writing short stories in school and stuff like that?
Well, actually writing short stories, I was 11 when I really got going with it, and I actually wrote a complete book of ghost stories called Ghostly Tales, in fact. Well, I say ghost stories, I mean some other things in it. I mean, I actually pinched a Shoggoth not out of Lovecraft, but out of Robert Bloch, because I read a Bloch story called Notebook Found in a Deserted House in a British magazine, which, where incidentally I discovered when Bob and I became friends later on, that Bob had never known that reprint had taken place, so somebody ripped him off. And so, you know, a Shoggoth was like a tree with mouths. So, and in fact, there's a dictionary definition in the story where somebody looks up a Shoggoth and he says, a tree with mouths. So there you are. There's a dictionary definition for you. and the stories, you can tell, I think, from what I'm saying now, you know, they were kind of pieced together like Frankenstein's monster, you know, from bits from everywhere, just favourite bits. They had a certain structure to them, you know. They weren't very long. I mean, I think the most hugely ambitious is about 4,000 words long, and most of them are much, much shorter than that. And they are pretty terrible, I have to tell you. I will quote you a sentence, a representative sentence. The door banged open and the aforementioned skeleton rushed in. There you are. You're all the same. Bob Price, actually, had the Crypt of Cthulhu, his fanzine. His little magazine. He reprinted the entire thing. And I think you can still find that on, you know, Abe books and places. I think it's selling for some horrible amount, far more than it's worth it, I think. But there you are. So I experimented, as you say, you know, for some years. And I had to go at imitating Arthur Machen. So I was beginning to home in on, you know, trying to use a single example to learn from. And that is pretty terrible too. And then I had to go at John Dixon Carr, the detective story writer, whose work I very much like, still do actually. But I didn't finish that novel either. And now this is something you need to your listeners may well not have realised, or it may find it difficult to believe. Perfectly true, though, that by 1960, there was never been a single Lovecraft collection in British paperback. There's only ever been one collection in hardcover back in the 50s. And then out came Cry Horror, which in fact Don Walheim had edited, I think, for Avon Books back in the 40s, which is a collection of Lovecraft stories. And I found this in a shop for half a crown. And I remember being panicked. I didn't have enough money in my pocket to buy it, but I just did, you know, the last farthing. I managed to plonk on the counter and got the book. And following day, I just skived off school and read the book from cover to cover. And I was absolutely immersed in it. I thought, this is Well, I mean, remember, I'm 14 years old now. But I thought not only is this the greatest horror fiction I've ever read, and you know, the pinnacle to which everything else has been, climbing, but I thought it was the greatest book I'd ever read. Well, it's not quite that now, but I still, you know, very highly regard Lovecraft for, you know, for his modulation of language and his structure and his inventiveness and the fact that, you know, he tried out all the forms that he possibly could for, well, what he called weird fiction. And at this point, I knew this is what I wanted to do. You know, I want to do stories like these. And so I duly started off doing so and imitating him, to put it mildly. Well, I was imitating the easy bits. I was imitating the purple prose, of which there's far less than, you know, people think. You know, if you look closely or read a story, you know, with any attention, you'll find that he builds up to that sort of prose, if it's even there. And in some stories, like, you know, The Colour Out of Space, it almost isn't. It's, you know, well, but this is the easy bit to imitate, as I say. So, you know, everything was eldritch and amorphous and, you know, unspeakable, so forth, in my stories. And I set them in Massachusetts. I mean, I'd never been more than 20 miles from Liverpool, but there you go. And it showed, believe you me. But then, at the suggestion of a correspondent, Pat Kearney, who was a fellow Lovecraft fan, and one of my, actual pen pals of the time. He later became a great historian of erotica, by the way, Patrick J. Kearney. But he suggested I should send them off to, well, actually, just ask August Derleth at Arkham House if they were any good. You know, just basically that, not send them for publication. So I wrote Derleth a letter saying, you know, "Dear Mr. Derleth, you're the world's leading authority on Lovecraft, and I've written these stories. You know, do you think you could have a look at them and see if they're any good?" And he said, "Well, you know, we need to look at this because, you know, we have the copyright on Lovecraft's ideas," which is arguable, but anyway, that's what he said in time. So I sent them to him, and he eventually sent me back a two-page letter saying, "You know, these need a lot of work, and, you know, by God, do they ever!" And he made various suggestions as to how they could be improved. And but he said, "If you will do this work and flesh them out, which is what they needed as well, and if you have more stories of the same kind, enough to make up a book, we think it might be a potential Arkham House book for us to publish." Well, you know, 14 years old. Wow, you know, that was pretty fighting talk. So, you know, I duly did all the work, and he eventually, well, he bought a story for an anthology, first of all, you know, as a kind of trailer for the book of mine he was going to publish. And then comes, well, I'm 18, and he actually did publish that first book of mine, The Inhabitant of the Lake. And in fact, when I think about it, you know, it's the 60th anniversary of that very book, and there's a special limited edition coming out here this year from PS Publishing.
You mentioned, you know, early on you try to imitate Lovecraft, Robert Bloch, and Arthur Machen. Can you pinpoint where you think you kind of broke free from that and formed your own voice?
Well, you know, even looking back on that first book, I can see myself beginning to move and, you know, writing more like myself. And there's one story, it's not very good, but a story called The Will of Stanley Brooke, where I deliberately did without all the, you know, the adjectives and so forth. And it's told in very, very plain, bare prose with no atmosphere at all. So that was kind of an experiment, you know, a conscious experiment even there. But yeah, but the moment where, or the story where, yeah, I can tell you precisely. It's a story called The Cellars, which I wrote when I was 19. And it was the first story that actually was based in Liverpool. And in fact, it's got a very detailed description of what the Liverpool city centre was like then. There's a walk through it that the characters take on the way to the sub-cellars that are the core of the story. And in fact, they were real. I mean, it was a friend of mine, a bookseller, John Rowles, who had a bookshop near them in the city centre. And they were open to, you know, anybody who wanted to go down there, you could just explore them. And it seemed like there was, I don't know, half a mile of them. And you had to take a flashlight down with you because there are no lights, obviously. Once I'd been through there, I knew that, you know, this has got to be a story. And indeed it was. And that was the first story of mine that was really based on an actual place, inspired by an actual place, if you like. And there were many more to come after that, not least, you know, places in Liverpool. But I'd also, I suppose I should explain this one other thing, that immediately after finishing that first book, The Inhabitants of the Lake, I'm just turning 17, I chanced upon, well, I say chanced upon, I saw and bought a copy of Nabokov's Lolita. And that was an absolute revelation to me of what you could do with prose and, with structure and obliquely approaching the theme. And that just completely freed my writing at that point. And the really, I suppose, the Sellers is the first big instance of that development.
Just speaking on Mr. Derleth for a second, just as someone who's very young and you're influenced by Lovecraft, it has to be at least pretty cool or encouraging to have August Derleth publish your first works.
Oh, very much so, Lord, yes. I mean, hell's teeth, because I've been collecting Arkham books for years, and in fact, it was something I would never even have dreamed of. But then again, I would never have dreamed of being published by Weird Tales, but partly because it was defunct at the time, but later, of course, it's risen from its own ashes or from its own grave, more appropriately, several times. And of course, I have been in there, so that was another dream I wouldn't even have dreamed of having, and there we are.
So would you say that your writing process has changed since those early days, or are you more of a heavy outliner, or you like to go with the flow and fix it later type of deal?
Oh no, I mean, for decades I've not plotted in advance, even a novel. What I will do, I gather a lot of material. Over the months, whatever, when I've got an idea for a novel, particularly a novel, and I have many, many notebooks, of which here is one right now. And these days I tend to use the phone as a notebook while I'm out of the house, but I'll enter the ideas I get in here, and when it seems like I've got enough material to feel the whole thing feels anxious to be written, then I will give it a shot. I mean, obviously you've got to have some sense of the broad sequence of events, and clearly you've got to know where to start, or you never will start. So you've got to work out your early chapters at the very least. But that's pretty well all I do in advance, because I genuinely like the thing to develop organically in the writing. The other thing, which I mean, that the first few novels were plotted in advance. Actually, it was only into the I suppose early 80s that I began to move away from that. But one change, though, that's crucial in the difference from my early days till now. I mean, there was a time, and I'm afraid for too long, I would try and salvage as much of the first draft of a story as I possibly could. I try and justify keeping as much as I could. These days, I'll get rid of or improve or even jettison as much as I possibly could. And I basically take great delight in seeing that I can get rid of half a page of this stuff and to its considerable improvement. So the older I get, the more ruthless I get with the rewrites, and I think that's a good thing.
Are you a day writer or a night writer?
Oh, very much day. I mean, 6 in the morning, I'm at it basically, and that will be till like late morning, lunchtime, something like that. Particularly, if it's the first draft. And then in the afternoon, I'll do other stuff like non-fiction, something like that. So I tend to work, seven days a week. Sunday's my half day off, admittedly. We go out and have a walk or something. But otherwise it's going to be me till mid-afternoon, and then we get to watch a movie on Blu-ray or something like that.
Is there any difference between your approach when you're doing a short story versus a novel?
Not really, no. I think the approach is the same. Obviously, to some extent, you've got to pare it away more in the first draft of a short story. I mean, a short story, I think, is about as much about what you leave out as what you put in. Whereas I think a novel, is one of the exciting things for me, is with it does develop its own energy and momentum, and I basically, in both cases, a short story or a novel, what I want to do is come up here to my desk where I've been talking to you right now, and surprise myself and write something I didn't know I was going to write until it suggested itself. And if I can do that, then well, basically it's about engaging the imagination. But if I can do that, I'm happy for the day.
In regards to working with characters that have been established by another author, like obviously you have some great Solomon Kane stories by Robert E. Howard. So how do you toe the line between, trying to give it the same feel of that classic character and have your own voice input into it?
Well, I tried to do away with my own voice to some extent in the case of that, because it was that I was asked to do these, as you say, complete these three Solomon Cain stories that Robert E. Howard had left unfinished, and I just tried to mould the prose as much as possible to the fragments, and stay as much out of the way as I possibly could, I hope I achieved that. I mean, there is later, of course, I did the novel of the film Solomon Cain as well. And I was just trying to be as close to the maker's intentions as possible. And having said that, I actually was given several different drafts of the script. And there were a couple of scenes that I think they didn't have time to film, or possibly the budget to film. So I included those in the novel. But again, as far as I'm concerned, to try and stay as close to, the originator as possible.
Those Ryer stories, were those, and they were initially published in Andrew J. Offit's Swords Against Darkness.
Yes.
There were four of those. Were those four stories originally intended to be sort of an episodic novel?
No, it wasn't that. It was actually, what was going on there was that my agent, Kirby McCauley, sadly no longer with us, this was back in 73, 74, I'd just gone full-time as a writer, and luckily my wife, Jenny, was a teacher, and, otherwise, if she hadn't kept us for several years, you wouldn't be talking to me now, believe me. But Kirby said, basically, horror is that there's not much market for horror. Of course, a couple of years later, things really did change. And so he suggested, I should branch out a bit and, do science fiction or fantasy. Well, I did a bit of science fiction, which was really not very good at all. And then I had to go at fantasy, where I was a bit better. And the first of those Ryer stories, The Sustenance of Hoek, that was just an idea I had. And I thought, this could be a sort of sword and sorcery story. And so it was the first one I really tried in terms of having a... Well, it wasn't going to be a serious character, but sort of swordsman character at its centre. I duly wrote that. Kirby sent it off to Andy Offutt, who bought it. He said it was a bit long, so I actually cut about 4,000 words out of it, to his astonishment and delight, which certainly improved the story as well. And then that anthology did well, so Andy said, could I do another one, another story of Ryer? And as you say, we ended up with four of them. And then, sadly, that anthology series came to an end, and so did poor old Ryer, because, there wasn't much of a market for him other than that. However, funnily enough, I've just written a new one this year, because there's going to be a book of... sort of Lovecraftian stories in which the contributors have been asked to set them in their sort of fantasy worlds. And so I thought, well, why not resurrect him? And in fact, he's now getting on in years, as indeed is his creator. So I suspect it has something to do with that. It's my little mythos, the Britishster mythos of Deoloth. And so he figures in this story. And I was kind of happy to get back, because I thought for a long time, having been asked, I thought, I'm never going to be able to do this. It's too far into the past. I mean, nearly 50 years since I wrote these stories. But no, eventually it suggested itself, and I've duly done it. I find it interesting that the style, the prose changes. It's a lot sparer, I think, even in the first draft, for those stories than it is for, most of my stuff. And so I did find my way back to that, the guy who created Ryer, and there he is again. But I think this may be a swan song.
Your introduction to Robert Howard, was it the horror story, the more mythos horror side of his works, or was it the sword and sorcery side?
The very first one I read was The Black Stone, in one of the late issues of, digest-sized issues of Weird Tales. So that was horror initially. But then I got Skullface and others from Arkham House. It was then, still in print, actually, just about. So that gave me a backing, background in his fantasy as well, not least because that rather remarkable title story, Skullface, which is Sax Roma, but cranked up in Howard's inimitable way.
There seems to be a necessary marriage between horror and sword and sorcery. Howie and I were talking about this a few weeks ago. What's the distinction that you make between a sword and sorcery tale and maybe a typical fantasy story?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I suppose you tend to get more combat in sword and sorcery. You know, you have to have some sort of action scene. Whereas, you know, something like, say, Lord Dunsany or Lovecraft's fantasies, for that matter, they're more sort of evocative of the fantastic and the exotic. But, of course, you can do that too in a sword and sorcery story. So, you know, maybe the sword and sorcery story is the amalgam, if you like.
In the, I got the collection right here, the Far Away and Never. I don't know if you can see it.
Yes, I see it. Yes.
You mentioned that, how much was of an influence was Clark Ashton Smith on the setting of Tond? I believe I'm saying it correctly.
Oh, I think a bit. So particularly in the first story I ever wrote about this imaginary world. And I mean, I've always loved his fantasy, which again, a lot of which has a distinctly horrific or macabre element. But yeah, I mean, I don't think there's, I know a few writers of that kind who are more evocative. I mean, Fritz Leiber in a different way, but those are two favourites. And I think, I wasn't actually trying to imitate Smith, except possibly in that first story, Madness from the Vaults. I certainly think, he looms over my shoulder quite a bit in those stories, for sure.
Was there any particular inspiration that you pulled for the character of Ryer, if I'm saying that correctly?
No, not really. It was just, an attempt to do, a sort of sword-bearing, well, not particularly hero, but, sort of slightly heroic, I suppose, I suppose I was trying to do somebody along the lines of Conan, but slightly different as well. And, there he is, for what he's worth.
Yeah, he strikes me more as a Kane type. Carl Edward Wagner type.
Yes, now I hadn't, of course, read, you're thinking of Carl Edward Wagner now, right?
Yeah.
Now, of course, Carol and I became good friends later on, but, I hadn't then read those stories, I don't think. But was very fond of them when I did do.
How did you and Carl meet? Were you guys pen pals?
Let me think now. Had we corresponded? I think we probably had, actually, yes, because I forget exactly how this came about. It may have been, again, through Kirby McCauley, because he was Carl's agent, also Manly Wellman's agent, David Drake's agent. In fact, I met all these guys at the first World Fantasy Convention back in 75 in Providence. And indeed, that's where I met Robert Bloch and Frank Belknap Long, Joseph Payne Brennan, Gayle Wilson. Amazing times, and sadly, of course, nearly all gone now. But, I was privileged to have all these guys as friends, which is quite something.
What's your favorite film adaptation of Lovecraft's works?
I would say probably the two that the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society did, the Call of Cthulhu, if we're going to call him that, and The Whisperer in Darkness. But I particularly like The Call, because it actually feels like a film that had been made in the year that the story was published. An amazing achievement, and it's sometimes said to be amateur. Well, if it's amateur, it's in the best sense of amateur, of somebody who loves the material and seems to be, to immerse themselves completely in it. And produce something very, very remarkable. The film that I always regard as Lovecraftian, although it's not directly based on Lovecraft at all, but it seems to me that it has all the elements that Lovecraft wanted to be in this sort of fiction, the elusiveness, the sense of enigma and terror, and nothing is shown directly. And also the documentary quality that Lovecraft, was particularly in his later work, was trying for. And that's the Blair Witch Project. Mm. And even the title seems to be to have that sort of sound of the facts in the case of Monsieur Voldemar, that kind of a thing.
The location as well.
Absolutely, yes, that's right. And the other thing to be said is I found it very frightening. I mean, I knew it was a fake documentary when I saw it, so it wasn't that, but even so, I think it works extraordinarily well in its own terms as that kind of, quasi-documentary approach to horror. Sadly, these days, I can't watch it even on a television because the shaky cam does me in, sadly.
So, Ramsey, out of all your works, be it a short story or a novel, was there anyone that was the most challenging to write? Is the one you lost sleep over?
Oh, well, no, I suppose I have lost sleep on occasion. I suppose lost sleep is woke in the middle of the night and, had to scribble something down. So I go out on the landing so I don't wake Jenny up and switch on the light out there and, with the notebook. But I mean, there have been some that I've struggled with, in the process. The influence was one. I remember finding I was about halfway through that and feeling that I was sort of floundering a bit. Oh, probably Midnight Sun, actually, when I think about it. Midnight Sun. I wrote the first section of that book, which is the protagonist as a boy, about 50 pages, I suppose. And I honestly felt I was sort of fighting uphill somewhere and getting absolutely nowhere. And very unusually for me, because as I say, I write 7 days a week. I actually took time out from it. Well, I think we'd gone to a convention, a science fiction convention, I think, at Easter somewhere. And so I took the thing with me and just read through what I'd done so far. And I found there was more than I'd thought. There was stuff I could build upon. I think it's partly the ambition of that book. I mean, I was very consciously trying to do cosmic terror and specifically trying to avoid any kind of physical horror, And I think, I have done things like that since. I mean, The Wise Friend, I think there's nothing in the way of physical horror in that. Or The Kind Folk, I think, and a few others. But those, just came naturally out of the material. Whereas I think the very fact that I'd set out to do this in Midnight Sun became, something of a hindrance almost, certainly in terms of what I felt, how I felt while I was writing it. Oh, having rewritten it and particularly cut down that opening section, I think it did improve. And while for a long time I regarded it as being sort of an honourable failure, but I think that's because I could see what I was trying to do and then what I had achieved, which is, fallen short of my ambition. But I think looking back on it these days, and we reissued it quite recently, I think it's better than I thought. I think it does achieve something, even if not everything I wanted.
Were there any movies, horror films made in recent years? For example, maybe like The Witch or Blackcoat's Daughter or The Lighthouse or any of those type of movies that left an impression on you?
All of those did for a start. Yes, oh, they all did. Yeah, I'm also very fond of Ari Aster, and I have to say, I thought Beau Is Afraid is the greatest comedy of paranoia I think I've ever seen, and even including on film, including the trial, the Orson Welles. I mean, the first section in particular of Beau Is Afraid in the city, I mean, I just think is absolutely magnificent, a work of genius. So yeah, I mean, is that a horror film exactly? I don't know, but it's my kind of horror anyway, so my kind of nightmare. For sure, I've watched it several times now, and each time I just think it improves. There's a movie called, which is on Shudder, on the Shudder channel, called Speak No Evil. Does that ring any bell at all?
I've heard of it, have not seen it.
Ah, well, I commend it to you. But I have to say this, that Jenny and I, well, these, we've seen lots and lots of horror movies because she loves them too. But we were at the end of that film, we were just left completely shaken. I'll say no more than that. But I mean, it starts out as a kind of Scandinavian comedy of social embarrassment, kind of almost a sort of thing Mike Leigh makes in England, or has done in the past. But then, and this is apparently how they started out, the filmmakers. But then they found it was getting darker, and so they thought, well, okay, we'll follow this and see where it goes. And by God, it goes places that personally we didn't want it to go. But you can see the inevitability of it when it gets there. And I found, I did find that completely terrifying and very disturbing. The other, well, not quite so recent, but the other filmmaker whose films, half a dozen of whose films terrify me on an absolute visceral level in a way that nobody else does, is David Lynch. And I suppose if I had to say one, it would be Lost Highway, which I, the first section of which I just found absolutely terrifying whenever I see it, just a sort of end-to-end terrifying. But then again, Mulholland Drive, equally. Fire Walk With Me, which I think is grievously underrated in some quarters, which again I find profoundly disturbing. And there are times in all those films actually when I find myself thinking, if this scene goes on much longer, I'm going to have to bail out. I'll just pause it and come back. But it doesn't quite get there, but it comes down close at times.
We were talking about this a few weeks ago, Ramsey, before we chatted with you, that there's a few writers in horror. You know, you have some writers that have an up and down approach to the horror and the story, but you have a more constant sense of dread that's present in the writing. You and very few, it's almost Ligotti. You and Ligotti do that. Yes. I was going to ask if you were a fan of Thomas Ligotti.
Oh, very much so, yeah. No, I did the introduction to his first book, actually, Songs of a Dead Dreamer. Oh, yeah. Very much an admirer.
How do you go about maintaining that sense of dread through a whole story as opposed to just having moments of horror in the story?
I don't know. It's instinctive. That's all I could really say, you know.
Good answer.
But you know, I think it is the influence of Lovecraft, the influence of M.R. James, you know, is the gradual accumulation of detail. So, you know, I try to plant those things as we go along. And, you know, there's always that sense, as you say, of something not quite right and getting it increasingly wrong as we go ahead.
You're able to do that through a whole novel.
Well, it's more difficult, obviously, because of course you've got that scope. But I think that's one of the things you used. That's not all the novel does, you know. The novel's about a great deal else, but I think that there's that presence of dread, I think, always hovering in the background at least.
So what would you say is the best bit of writing advice that you've been given, and who gave it to you?
Oh, probably August Derleth saying, you know, don't try and make a living at it till you can, you know, get a job and, you know, write in your spare time, which I duly did, and he was right for sure. And you know, how right he was proved when I went full time and, you know, really didn't make it for about 5 years. So, you know, that's what I would say to any writer who's starting out, or, you know, don't depend on it, for heaven's sake. Because, you know, do your best work and eventually who knows where you may get to.
Your full-time job, obviously. So how do you find time to read anymore, or you pretty much had enough of that in the early years, or how does that
reading?
Work?
Oh, no, I still read, yeah, but not as much as I did. And sadly, I've slowed down as a reader more than anything else. But, you know, I still try and find time to read. And, you know, not just horror by any means. I mean, the most recent thing I read was Dennis Lehane's novel, Small Mercies, which is extremely powerful stuff, I have to say, about one of his Boston novels. Very, very harrowing indeed. But not horror, but crime, you know. But, you know, I still do read plenty of horror. I mean, at the moment, I'm reading John Linwood Grant's collection, Margrave, and that's very splendid indeed.
Is there any nonfiction that you read or look towards to inspire yourself or anything like that?
Not directly, but I mean, you know, I will research something if I need to, and then you know, read a whole lot around the subject. I suppose the most I ever did in terms of that was Creatures of the Pool, which is, you know, in some ways is my ultimate Liverpool novel, because it draws very much on the history of mostly the city, the centre. Of Liverpool, and I bought dozens of old books. I mean, the older the better, actually. If they hadn't been reprinted, better still. And, you know, found all sorts of strange and curious legend and history, and I tried to incorporate all of that I possibly could in the book. And what interestingly happened was then, because I'd done the research over several years, which is unusual for me for a novel, but I wanted to get everything I could find, and so I would basically make notes as I do, and sometimes I would transcribe something from my reading, sometimes I'd paraphrase it, sometimes I would actually kind of invent based on my reading. And the thing is, I can't now remember which is which all the time. So I actually, you know, the book does it to me just as I hope it does it to the reader. And I don't quite know what's invented and what's not. And I very much hope that people won't know that either.
That's how you know it's good.
That's right. Now, I'll mention one thing. I mean, I know you haven't asked me about this, but I'll just throw this in for the hell of it, because it is relevant. I recently wrote, and this was several years in the making as well, a book-length appreciation of the Three Stooges. You know, Mo, Sharon, Mo, Curly and Larry, and Shemp, obviously, and the ones who came after that too, the third stooge. And one thing's in there, you may be familiar with a movie called Room 237, about Stanley Kubrick's movie The Shining, which is basically, you know, various people's, shall we say, bizarre theories in the, you know, in which they expound at great length with you know, illustrative footage. So that, for instance, one guy's convinced that The Shining is actually Kubrick's confession that he staged the moon landing, and you can see all the clues in the film if you look, he says. Well, I've actually written an essay in this book which I prove that The Shining is actually a tribute to the Three Stooges, and there's lots of evidence, guys. I mean, just think of it. After, you know, give me the bat, Wendy. Give me the bat. Now, Mo would say that, you know.
I can't disagree with you. Ramsey, this is a question I like to ask everyone. Have you ever had an experience you would consider supernatural or paranormal?
Yes. I mean, basically, our house here is haunted, we feel. I mean, this is, I should explain, this is the big Victorian semi, three stories. I'm up here on the top floor. And the room behind me, not, I mean, this room is my workroom, but the room adjacent is the guest room, or one of the guest rooms. It's a big one. And there have been a number of things in there. Coins tend to appear in there. I mean, it's apparently a common thing. It's a very odd, and it seems meaningless, but that's what happens. And I once did see a coin drop on the carpet out of nowhere, just an old, you know, sort of ordinary English penny, you know? And that we feel, I mean, well, here's the story, the initial story. Many years ago, probably about 50 years ago, not long after we'd moved in here, actually, we came home one day to find that the house had been burgled. And, you know, they'd pinched our stuff, including all of Jenny's jewellery. You know, all the sentimental value, this kind of a thing. Which they'd taken from our bedroom, which is on the middle floor, just beneath the room I'm in now. And, you know, they've stolen all this jewellery. And so, but then we went up the house to find out, and somebody, they pinched my, this was way back when, but your CD player. Well, you know, I got that back on the insurance. That was, by the way, it was the jewellery we were unhappy about, of course. And we found them, everything, in a bag in this room next to mine on the top floor. So something had panicked them, you know, and made them flee and drop their swag, you know, in that room. There's no question of it, we think. And so whenever we go away now, Jenny always says, you know, well, look after the house for us, you know, whatever you are, basically. And we think it does. Now, here's a final anecdote. I used to snore immoderately, well, I still do occasionally, but I've got a spray to deal with that now. And this was back when Jenny was teaching. So every so often, I would go up to the guest room and give her a night off so, you know, she could, you know, have a good night's sleep, basically. And one night, I should explain that this other room has a skylight, so it's never totally dark. There's always a, you know, kind of a twilight in the room. And I woke in the middle of the night, or about 2 a.m, I suppose. I thought, oh, you know, Jenny's actually taken pity on me and, you know, doesn't want to leave me alone up here, and so she's come and join me in bed. And then I realised that the person lying next to me in bed was not Jenny at all. And the silhouette, which was, you know, about, you know, a foot away from me on the other pillow. And all I could make up was this, you know, this silhouette. And I've never been so terrified in my life, well, not since that incident of the dark when I was, you know, in my teens. I couldn't move. Now, you know, Jenny said, well, you know, this is basically sleep paralysis. And maybe that's what it was. But all I could say is it just didn't feel like that. And all I could do, and obviously, you know, if you wrote it in a piece of fiction, nobody would believe it. The only thing I could think of to do was shut my eyes and hope this thing would go away. At which point I had the sense of a face coming very close to mine, like this close, and waiting for me to look at it. And I didn't. And after a long time, that went away too. And that was the end of that. But, well, me, I'm convinced that was something.
I'll say, did that moment influence any writing?
Not yet, no. I'm sure it'll show up sometime, but not yet. Not directly.
So I'm reading The Lonely Lands right now. Yes. I'm almost on page 100 of that. And that is kind of like this weird ghost story, would you say? Or, I mean, how would you describe, I mean, just sum it up in a sentence or two?
Well, I mean, I think it's about a guy who, having lost his wife, becomes possibly harmfully obsessed with the afterlife and may be altering her afterlife in ways he would prefer not to do.
Really, really compelling read. And also, you have, now you're pretty much publishing a book a year, right? Because you have, I think it's Incubation coming out in November this year,
right?
That's
right. Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
and that is a new novel, correct?
It is. It is indeed. Yeah. Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Or
Yeah. Sure. It's about the idea of a twin town. You know, the towns were twinned after the Second World War. I mean, places in England or Britain, you know, and in Germany or Europe, partly, you know, to try and mend international relations after the war. And in this particular case, the central character has been a pen pal with a girl in the Bavarian Alps, and eventually goes to visit her, only to bring back far more than he thought, and, you know, something that was going to infect, in a supernatural sense, the town around him at home.
So it's very interesting. Does this span a length of time, quite a length of time, or just what is the time span in that?
Oh, well, it mostly takes place in you know, something like the present day, but there are a number of scenes set back in his school days when he starts corresponding with the girl. And they are very important, too, in terms of things that happen here before he goes over there. So, sure. But in the main, it's set in the present day.
Great. Well, we're certainly looking forward to that.
Well, I hope you like it. I hope you like it.
I'm sure I will.
Yes, sir. Ramsey, you just kind of shared a bit with us, just to put a bow on this here. Is there anything else on the horizon you can think of to point people towards, or anything like that?
Oh, well, I mean, they're actually doing, as a sort of, not quite a trilogy, but a trio, actually. Because of this, you know, my 60th anniversary, so Flame Tree are going to be doing this special deluxe-looking edition of The Incubations, and also a collection of Lovecraft and a collection of M.R. James, to each of which I've written the introduction, and also each of them also has a sort of, as an appendix, if you like, a story of mine in that vein. So, you know, they're going to be in this sort of very, very handsome uniform edition in November.
Great.
As the nights draw in.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate you a lot, man. It's been a great time chatting with you here.
Yeah, oh, thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, Ramsey, you have a great rest of your day. And once I get this posted and pretty, I'll send you a link.
Great. Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Guys. Bye-bye. Bye.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Ramsey. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you back next time.
Monsters, madness, and magic.